Hey, you want that to go?
Yeah, we've got your takeouts on news stories this week. And the first takeout comes from Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. They have their first article in a new series that examines the new poor. So, Louise, let's start there. Who are the new poor? New with a capital N.
The new poor in this series are the people who were comfortably in the middle class before the Great Recession that we have been going through began. And they're people who have now been unemployed for a long time. You know, there are more than 6 million people who have been unemployed for more than 6 months, which is the highest level since this stuff has been tracked, since these numbers of long-term unemployed have been tracked. And there's real questions about these formerly middle-class people, if they will ever get back to the middle class, because we don't know if there'll be job creation strong enough to take all these people back.
Well, we've been the country and economists have been talking about the death of the middle class, the possible death of the middle class, for a very long time. Is that actually what we're seeing, or is this kind of, we don't know yet?
So what happens is every recession we've had in the last 20 years has gutted the middle class more and more. We're moving away from the 1950s. When you look at the figures, before 1990, it took about 21 months after a recession for the jobs that were lost to come back. In the 1990 recession, it took 31 months. In the 2001 recession, it took 46 months. It's taking longer and longer. This recession, 15 million unemployed. We don't know if they'll come back. And that's really because our economy is increasingly not a worker's economy. This is a profit shareholder return economy. And businesses, as they recover, are going to try to automate and only bring back the workers they really need. They're not going to be out trying to hire the masses.
Okay, Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
For our next takeout now, let's check in on Vancouver and the Olympics with Jason Stallman covering the Olympics for our partner, The New York Times. Jason, the ice dancing finals are tonight. We've got Canadians in the lead. We've got Americans in second and fourth place. Looks like we might have some good news for the U.S. on the podium tonight.
Certainly could see some good news for the United States. Perhaps Canada needs it more than the United States does, though, at this point.
On the ice, right.
They're own the podium program. You know that Canada sunk millions of dollars into this effort to finish atop the overall medals table, and the United States has been dominating so far. So, yeah, Canada would love to grab a medal in ice dancing or anything right now.
And staying on the ice, of course, women's hockey semifinals. What are the two matchups we have coming up?
Well, you have the United States playing Sweden and Canada against Finland. Based on the results so far in round-robin play, it really looks like it's going to be Canada against the United States for a gold medal. This is a sport that boils down to two teams, really. Same sort of thing that happened with women's softball before it was removed from the Olympic program. Two countries are dominating, and everybody else is just trying to score a goal here and there.
You know, the United States has been absolutely rolling over its opponents in hockey, sometimes with double-digit scores. We want to point out that later this morning, we're talking to the U.S. women's hockey coach and lead scorer for the 1980 Miracle on Ice team. Today marks the 30th anniversary of that U.S. hockey victory over the USSR in Lake Placid. You'll be able to hear the full interview on our website, thetakeaway.org, right after the show. Jason, thanks for being with us from Vancouver. Jason Stallman covers the Olympics for the New York Times.
And for our last takeout, we turn to California, where it may not be quite so golden for people who abuse animals. It turns out animal abusers could soon be treated like sex offenders in legal ways anyway. To tell us how that works is Jesse McKinley, San Francisco Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning.
In what ways are animal abusers in this proposal going to be treated like sex offenders?
Well, the basic concept is that the state, if they could pass this bill and get Arnold Schwarzenegger to sign off on it, would establish an online registry whereby anyone accused of felony-level animal cruelty charge would be listed online, very much in the way of sex offenders, with their name, their home address, their place of employment, and their criminal record.
And who would be looking at this online registry?
It would be open to anyone. Anyone who, you know, has an internet connection could essentially get online and find out if their neighbor had, you know, been convicted of running an animal fighting ring or hoarding or, you know, a variety of felony-level offenses. Now, keep in mind that most animal cruelty charges are actually misdemeanors, and it's somewhat rare for a prosecutor to actually go for a felony charge. But, you know, as we saw in a case like Michael Vick, it certainly does happen.
Yeah, but I guess the operative question here is what about the pound? Are they going to check that registry before they allow someone to adopt an animal? What about a pet store?
Conceivably, that would be one of the uses. In talking to prosecutors about this, particularly with puppy mills, places that generate large numbers of dogs, sometimes illegally, a lot of these people will skip from state to state to state, basically looking for a jurisdiction where they're not going to be prosecuted or not gone after with the same intensity. So backers of this idea think that this would be a great way for people to kind of track these people as they move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Are other states considering doing programs like this?
Tennessee had taken this up in 2008. It got through the Senate. I think it stalled after that. This idea has been around for a little bit. It's been tinkered with. But in California, which has a very strong record of animal rights laws, in particular Proposition 2, which outlawed battery cages for egg-laying hens, the state's voters have seemed to be very, very much in favor of this. And the backer of this, Dean Flores, who's the Senate majority leader, seems to think he's got the votes to get it through.
And, well, you know, we're seeing this kind of thing in other areas of law enforcement. They not only have this for child sex offenders, but they also have this John's TV I've seen in many cities, and now this with animal abusers. Is this perhaps law enforcement trying to use broadened communication to crack down?
Certainly, and I think that for some civil libertarians, this is also somewhat troubling in that it turns people on a level of animal abuse into pariahs. But the backers of this, which include this group called the Animal Legal Defense Fund, feel very strongly that this is simply publishing public records and using that information to kind of keep people aware of who they're living next to or hiring.
Okay, Jesse McKinley is the San Francisco Bureau Chief for our partner at the New York Times.